Most of what we hear in the media about the environment and war can be dramatic. There will be war over water in the future. But the reality is the environment plays a subtler but crucial role in most all conflicts. Thomas Homer Dixon is chair of Peace and Conflict Studies at the Center for Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Toronto. He's the author of Environment, Scarcity, and Violence, and his newest book is The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. Homer Dixon led a research team that looked into the relationship between environmental resources and conflict, and he tells us how the over-dramatization of the links between environment and war do us no favors.
First of all, I'm very sensitive and, in a sense, respectful of the concerns about over-dramatization and sensationalizing these problems, because I think that frequently when people want to draw attention to their own particular concern, they'll say, this factor is going to cause war. We have to pay attention to water because it's going to cause a lot of war. We have to pay attention to food because it's going to cause war. And it's a way of making it sound like the issue that you're particularly concerned about is of world-shaking importance. My general response, though, to people who say this is all just sensationalism is that conflicts of all kinds are caused by multiple factors. There's some that are proximate causes that could be triggers, for instance, of a particular event, maybe a political breakdown that leads to a conflict or an assassination or a particular terrorist attack. But then there can be deeper causes, what people often refer to as root causes. And these can be complex, and there can be many of them operating simultaneously. And I think what we find when we look at many conflicts around the world is that there are material factors in the sense of resources and natural stresses, environmental stresses that often turn out to be quite important. There are always many things operating, and they combine in complex ways. Frequently, though, analysts, especially social scientists, who aren't terribly comfortable with thinking about the natural world and variables that are derived from the natural world, neglect these environmental factors. They don't take them so seriously, and resource factors, and tend to dismiss them. And I think often they dismiss them prematurely. Because when we've looked around the world at many conflicts, we find that resource and environmental factors turn out, in some cases, to be very powerful and very important. Although they're always deep and distant causes, they're often not, they're very rarely proximate causes.
You talk about them as multipliers of stresses that are often already there.
That's right. Although I think that the best way to think about these situations frequently is that there are a bunch of factors all multiplying the force of each other. So you might have, for instance, in a particular situation, some deep ethnic cleavages, existing cleavages between tribal groups or ethnic groups. And then you layer on top of that, say, a drought or land degradation. And then you layer on top of that an economic crisis, say, induced by falling prices for the export crop, the country's export crop. And what you find when you take those three things together and you multiply them together is a very dramatic impact. Any one of them by itself might have been manageable. So it's not really possible to say that one is more important than the other. They all come together and converge in a way that can be really devastating for society and can lead to social breakdown and violence.
Starting in the 90s, you and the people there at the Peace and Conflict Studies Department at the University of Toronto began looking into the environment and how it interacted with conflicts around the world. And you came up with some conclusions, some case studies. Explain a little about this work.
Coming out of my doctoral work in the late 1980s, I decided to look at the intersection between environmental stress and conflict because those are two issues that I had a long-standing interest in. And I brought together a research team eventually at the University of Toronto of really first-class young researchers, and we started investigating ultimately about 15, 17 major studies in the world, case studies of situations where it looked like, at least at first glance, it looked like there was perhaps some relationship between environmental stress and violence. And we dug down into those cases. We went deep and did a lot of investigation, in many cases sent people to do field work, and then tried to determine if there were linkages between environmental stress and conflict, and if so, how those linkages operated. And we learned from looking at all those different cases a lot of things. things about what these relationships look like, and we're able to develop some generalizations that I think have endured, and we're finding that they're still very relevant today.
Let's talk about some of the circumstances that we see out there today. And I know that the situation in Kenya looks like a straight political challenge debacle, but how does the environment fit into a circumstance like Kenya?
Well, it turns out that population stress and environmental stress, especially stress on land resources, are very powerful factors producing conflict between tribal groups and ethnic groups in Kenya. This is going back a long way, well over a decade, perhaps more than 20 years. The person who's really done the best work on this is Colin Call at the University of Minnesota. And he has shown that, especially in the Rift Valley in Kenya, that there are increasingly serious shortages of cropland. Now, the Rift Valley, which cuts across most of Kenya, is a place where really, in many cases, it's the richest agricultural land in the country. So it's a place where you have high population densities because people have settled there, black tribes, groups have settled there to engage in agriculture, to use the rich land. And also you found that there were, during the colonial period, very large white estates in those areas. Now, as population has grown very fast in the Rift Valley and in Kenya in general in recent decades, in fact, population growth rate was extremely high in the 60s and 70s, running somewhere around 3% a year, which gives you a doubling time for the whole population of just around 25 years or so. What you found is that those areas of very rich agricultural land became more and more densely inhabited, and the farms became smaller and smaller over time, and frictions between the various tribal groups became more serious. Now, for a long time, that didn't break to the surface. But eventually, in the 1990s, under President Daniel Arap Moi, there was an attempt by the president at that time to use the frustrations and anger that were generated surrounding land availability in the Rift Valley to encourage violence among Arap Moi's followers and against his opponents. So basically, the president used especially members of his own tribe, the Kalenjin tribe, to attack members of opposing tribes, and sort of exploited the anger and frustrations that had arisen in those areas as a result of land scarcity. Simultaneously, during this period of time, not only was the land scarce because there were just more people living on it, but the land was becoming increasingly degraded, very serious soil degradation. So it meant that over time, the land was not as productive, it didn't yield as high crops. And all of this, of course, was having a big impact on the well-being, on the wealth of the inhabitants in the Rift Valley. And eventually that leads to a lot of frustration, and eventually that can lead to various kinds of intergroup rivalries over land availability, and that's exactly what the president was exploiting.
How much in these circumstances is the problem just unresolved? Because it seems like most of these circumstances, they still don't have a way for distributing land that is coherent or is going to solve the problem in the future. If the environment is part of the problem here, it seems like very often it just doesn't get solved as part of the problem in none of these circumstances.
This is a good question. I think that root causes frequently don't get addressed because they are really intractable. And in many cases, issues of land distribution and land degradation are very closely associated with the deep-seated structure of an economy, deep-seated landowning relationships, often between various castes or classes or ethnic groups. And you can't just walk in and sort of overturn this kind of thing. These structures, economic structures and relations between groups and forms of group identity evolve over generations and generations. And there are often only rare occasions when you can actually intervene to change something, for instance, through land redistribution. And for that to work, it often has to be very clever and the leadership has to be particularly astute. If you look at the situation in South Africa right now, which is another country that is facing quite extreme population pressures and land scarcity pressures, even with a black government that is dedicated to trying to rectify the imbalances in the economy that arose during the apartheid period, we're finding that it takes a very long period of time for changes to occur. And in fact, you can look next door at Zimbabwe, and you can make a good argument that a lot of the crisis in Zimbabwe is related to land distribution problems and a land distribution program that President Mugabe executed, which went awry. And why did he engage in that land redistribution? Because his followers, population of them, had grown very large, and he had no resources to provide them except the land of white farmers. And once again, we come back to resource distribution problems that are aggravated by deep-seated group identity and racial structures and economic structures that aren't easy to change. This is not a council of despair. I think that you can address these issues. The first step, though, is to recognize that they're there. If we take all of these conflicts as simply being motivated by the particular character of leaders or the particular animus between ethnic groups and don't look at these underlying resource and material factors, then we're missing a big part of the picture, and it means that we're probably not operating with a full set of policy tools in response.
You're listening to Worldview from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Jerome McDonnell speaking with Thomas Homer Dixon. He is the chair of Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Toronto, and he is the author of Environment, Scarcity, and Violence, amongst some of his books. He's also written more recently The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. I know that the Philippines sprung to mind when you were talking about long-running situations where small groups of people have controlled large amounts of the resources. And this was a post-colonial situation in the Philippines with the United States. And this has been the way it has for 100 years. It's been similar to the way it is now.
That's right. The Philippines is a very interesting case, and it's one that I've examined personally in some detail. Again, Colin Call at the University of Minnesota has recently updated this research. It's a situation that exhibits some of the characteristics that I discussed in the earlier cases. Again, we have a problem of land scarcity, aggravated by deforestation. And underlying population growth is a factor that has made this land scarcity much worse. The Philippines is essentially an archipelago of volcanic islands. The islands tend to have central mountainous regions, and then around the coastline there's a plain, a very fertile plain, that stretches out to the sea that in many cases, especially in the central part of the archipelago, is used for growing sugarcane. Land relations in the Philippines are essentially feudal in character and date back centuries, really, influenced strongly by the Spanish colonial regime, where you have a very powerful landowning elite that controls almost all the lowland agricultural land, the rich land. And then you have almost a serf class of landless peasantry that work on the big estates controlled by the landowning elite. Now, as the Filipino population grew very fast, essentially during the same period that we saw rapid population growth in Africa in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, the landless peasant population expanded very rapidly. And they didn't have any land available to them in the lowland areas. So you saw very large migrations of people from the lowlands into the central mountainous regions, the uplands in the Philippines. When they arrived in those upland areas, they engaged in something called Swidden agriculture, which is basically slash and burn agriculture on very steep slopes. And they were able to do this reasonably successfully for a long period of time. But eventually their population densities in these upland areas became so high that they weren't able to leave any of their land fallow to let it recover from their agriculture over a number of years. And so they would just constantly harvest. They would constantly burn and harvest. And now when you fly over many of these islands in the central part of the Philippines, as far as you can see, all the trees are removed and the slopes, which are often very steep, are very badly degraded with erosion gullies. And people are still trying to eke out a living in these areas, even though it's pretty meager now. The soil is washed away and there are no trees and the land is dried out. And it's in those areas, in the upland areas, where the government doesn't have much control, where the military has difficulty getting access, that you find that you have an ongoing insurgency, the New People's Army insurgency in the Philippines, which is kind of a Maoist communist insurgency that has been around for a long time, going back to the 1950s, and then especially vigorous under the Marcos presidency in the 70s and 80s, died down a bit when democracy came to the country, but has returned because, unfortunately, the underlying ecological stress, the underlying land problem has not been addressed effectively, even though there might have been a moment in time when Cory Aquino came to power when it could have been addressed. Unfortunately, you still have this very unequal land distribution and very dense, impoverished populations in upland areas that are really receptive to the kind of revolutionary message that the Maoists bring them.
And this is a circumstance that will be exacerbated by climate change, I imagine. The Philippines, an island archipelago, this is a prime real estate for layering another stress into
the
situation.
That's exactly right. In fact, the Philippines, I remember one time when I was traveling there, I was told that they get something like 50 or 60 major storms a year hitting the archipelago. And climate change is just one additional stressor that you're going to be layering on top all of this other stuff. And it affects the poorest first and worst, the people who are marginal, the people who have the least buffering capacity, eking out their lives on these very steep, eroded slopes and in places where there are no services or facilities to help them, no government extension services, no social networks except the ones they provide themselves. And you can see in these circumstances why frequently these communities of people will turn to insurgents who at least provide rudimentary protection against the depredations of paramilitary groups and landlords and also provide some rudimentary court services and policing and maybe some economic aid. Climate change will indeed make this situation a lot worse in many places in the world, not just in the Philippines, but in the Caribbean and also in Africa, which is one reason that I've been talking a lot recently about the relationship between climate change and security problems around the world.
And in the future, we're going to have to just get a lot better at doing the kind of things that you were just attributing to the rebel group in the Philippines. We've got to be able to create governance and food security and provide some kind of relief to people in a better way and think of that more as security.
That's exactly right. The key thing here is that when the resources become degraded in the countryside and people can't support themselves using those resources, then you need to provide alternative economic opportunities. People will often move out of the countryside into cities. It's one of the major reasons that the cities in poor countries have expanded very rapidly is because the landscape is often degraded, and so they've moved to the cities because they think they have a better opportunity for raising a living, for having a decent income in the cities. So it becomes really a matter of economic development. It becomes a matter of providing jobs to people who've been displaced from the landscape. Now, that may be in terms of industries that can export to elsewhere in the world, some kind of economic development in urban areas to absorb these large populations of migrants coming in from the countryside. But in many cases, you're not going to do very well re-employing people in the countryside because often the landscape is so badly degraded, the soil is so badly degraded, or the water's not available to support really vigorous economic activity anymore in the countryside, which is a huge consequence, a huge cost to these societies, because as most development experts will tell you, economic development experts, normally a poor country has to develop its agricultural economy first and then move later to its industrial development, because you get a capital accumulation from agriculture, and then using the capital that's been accumulated through agriculture, you use that as the savings to finance industrial development. In many cases, what's happened in these societies is because land degradation in the countryside is so serious, that opportunity or that option for agricultural development has largely been foreclosed. So it makes the job much more difficult now in terms of general economic development for these societies. They have to now focus on export industries and focus on urban economic development as opposed to economic development in the countryside.
Very interesting. Thomas Homer Dixon, thanks a lot for joining us and talking about the environment and security.
All the best.
Thomas Homer Dixon is chair of Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Toronto. He's the author of Environment, Scarcity, and Violence. His newest book is The Upside of Down, and we talked about some of his investigations into the relationship between environment and conflict.